Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, you're probably hoping the polar vortex took care of all the pests that were bothering you this last year. But I tell you what, that may not be the case. We'll find out. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. Our guest, PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, degrees in biological sciences and entomology. He'll talk about the effects of winter on insects, and we'll take all of your bug-related questions. So I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And PJ Leash, good to see you again.
Pleasure to be here, Larry.
Well, I bet we have a lot of people listening who are hoping the polar vortex killed invasive species. Did that happen?
Probably not, or it might have had some impacts, but I'm not expecting them to take them out of the equation. It's going to depend on a species-by-species basis, but the way I look at the overall polar vortex picture is if you think back about 5 years ago, we went through almost the same thing.
Yep.
Winter of 2014, we had a polar vortex that January that was really cold. There were businesses and schools closed just like this year. That following summer of 2014, we still had lots of insect activity in the state. So I think we're going to still have plenty of bugs around this year.
So what defenses do they have to, you know, make it through?
So lots of different strategies. And some of the insects will use these in combination. Some of them may go more towards one strategy than the other. One of the first things they do is a lot of insects simply have a life stage that is more resilient than the other stages, like an egg stage that is much more tolerant of drying out or desiccation or freezing. And so if you go through the winter as that life stage, that helps you out to begin with. Then we've got insects that specifically seek out sheltered locations. They might, in some cases, like stink bugs, some of them are Asian lady beetles, get into our homes. In other cases, those insects might go into a rotting log if they can get beneath the bark if it's loose.
Sure.
A rock pile, down amongst leaf litter on the ground. And one thing that stood out to me, at least in Madison area, by the time the polar vortex hit us, we had a good 6 or 8 inches of snow on the ground, which would have been a good insulating layer.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. One of the insects that I'm sure a lot of people worry about are the honeybees. They've been hit pretty hard in the past few years with seemingly a variety of things. Any word on how they did?
Yeah, so I haven't heard any numbers yet. I'm a little bit nervous, though, simply with the cold temperatures that we have. That can make it very challenging for honeybees. And honeybees are interesting the way that they spend the winter. They actually, instead of going dormant, like many insects do, they actually stay active. So they have enough food stores, their sugar sources in the honey, and they consume that, and they basically sit in the hive and make a ball of themselves, and they shiver and vibrate to make heat. And so if they don't have enough food going into winter, they're going to run out and cool down, and that's going to be the end of them. I have chatted with a commercial beekeeper over in southeast Wisconsin. He mentioned he's a little nervous. He's anticipating some heavy hive losses this winter due to the cold temperature. So I haven't seen the numbers yet, but I'm a little bit nervous for what we may hear.
Jeremy in Manitowoc County has a question about another insect and how it survived, I think. Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning. I'm just wondering if you have any sense on how the emerald ash borer has made it through this winter.
Yeah.
So that's a great question. I've had lots of folks ask that. And what's interesting is emerald ash borer comes from similar latitudes in East Asia. And so if you think about it, it's about as far north as us. It can be pretty well suited for cold winters. Emerald ash borer, the larvae is how they spend the winter. They actually have some natural antifreeze molecules or compounds they make in their body, but it's kind of like sidewalk salt. We know if it's really cold, the sidewalk salt just doesn't work once
right.
You get below a certain temperature. So insects like emerald ash borer have these compounds that prevent freezing. If it gets cold enough, they can freeze almost instantaneously. We'd call that a super cooling point. For emerald ash borer, that's down in the range of about minus 13 to minus 23 Fahrenheit.
Wow.
And if you think about the polar vortex, we did get down into that range, you know, minus 20s, minus 30s. The larvae, though, live beneath the bark of the tree. And so there's going to be some insulation there. If you had larvae on maybe the southwest side of a tree where you get some afternoon sun, that's going to warm it up a little bit. So in the grand scheme of things, I'm anticipating some larval mortality. I'm not expecting it to take Emerald Ashbar out of the equation, though. We're going to have some survivors, and when those survivors emerge, the females can easily lay dozens and dozens of eggs. So I'm looking at it as a little bit of a reprieve this year. They're probably going to bounce back. And interestingly, just a week ago, I had a sample come into the diagnostic lab. It was some branches from ash trees in Milwaukee County, and I was peeling bark to look for larvae. Total in there, I found 18 larvae. Of those, eight were severely discolored, telling me they had probably been killed by the cold, and they didn't have their typical pale color. I found four in there that looked good as far as I could tell. They had their usual color. And then there were six other ones that were actually parasitized by some of the little parasitic wasps that have been brought in and introduced. So when you look at those numbers, that's some fairly high mortality, but we still had some that looked like they were surviving in there.
Yeah, as long as you got a few.
Yep.
The weather turns better, and pretty soon you got lots more again.
Yep.
Well, you know, one of the, you mentioned survivors, and I know you did an article about woolly bear caterpillars and how they survive. And I thought that was pretty interesting. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so woolly bears, those are the common fuzzy black and brown caterpillars, and just about everybody sees these in fall. They kind of wander around looking for a sheltered spot to spend the winter. They've got a really unusual strategy in that they actually allow themselves to freeze, which might sound like a fatal mistake.
Yes.
What they do, though, their trick is they allow themselves to freeze very, very gradually. And by doing that, they are able to control in their body where the ice crystals form. If you have ice crystals that form within your cells, it's going to rupture the cells, and that's going to cause death. They can actually do it in a part of their body outside of the cells. So they very gradually make these ice crystals. When the ice forms, it starts pulling additional water out of the cells, and they've got some antifreeze compounds too. So they can literally freeze, and then in spring they warm up and do their thing, and they're perfectly fine.
Mother Nature is amazing sometimes.
It is, yeah.
Man. Well, let's take another call. John in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Good morning, guys. I have a more general question, not necessarily about the polar vortex, but I've seen reports about declining insect populations globally, that they've been sampling insect populations and they've seen a global decline. I'm wondering if there's any, if that's been reflected in insect populations in Wisconsin, and if it has, I wonder if there's been any environmental impact. And at what point is there an environmental impact, since they make up the biomass? The insects make up a lot of the biomass in the environment. I'm wondering when will we see an impact, if at all? Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks, John. Appreciate it. And this has come up in the past shows, too.
It has.
PJ, a lot of people are concerned about it.
Yeah, so it's definitely a topic that we've been hearing a lot about lately. I think there definitely are some of these declines going on. The problem is it's very, very hard to document. Insect populations, just by their very nature, can vary a lot from year to year. They can be influenced by rainfall and temperatures and things like that. And so if you only look at a short time period of 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you're going to see a lot of ups and downs. So it's hard to actually pull the trend out of that. You really need to look at long-term timescales. We're talking decades and decades. And it's hard to design those types of experiments. So there have been a few studies out there. There's a very well-known one from Germany a couple years back that looked at it for years and years, and they counted or measured the actual biomass or weight of the insects,
yeah.
And they showed some really surprising trends because they were in a natural area, forested area, and were documenting these declines. So we haven't had a study like that in Wisconsin. We do have some data, though, about certain insects. One we've probably heard about in the last few years would be that rusty patch bumblebee.
Yeah.
That was listed as an endangered within the last year or two. I mean, historically, that one used to be much more common, and now we know we don't see a whole lot of that one anymore. It's here and there, but their numbers have definitely gone down. So we have some data like that. I'd love to see a big study going for decades and decades to help point this out. We do have lots of anecdotal reports, though.
And yeah.
One of the common things we call the windshield effect. If you drive from southern Wisconsin up to Bayfield County, historically, you'd have to stop and squeegee off your windshield a couple times. And today, we don't have to do that as much.
Yeah.
So there are some of these signs out there, but it's very hard to actually study that.
Somebody else mentioned once on the show that some of that may be because of the design of cars now compared to years back. But so that could play a role, but I still think we're seeing fewer.
Yeah.
when I'm out there on my bike, I'm not eating nearly as many in 50 miles of biking as I used to.
Yeah.
Oh, if you want to look at it that way, that's my own anecdote. Brian in Arcadia, will turn to you next. Hi, Brian. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi, guys. I don't know if your guests can answer this, but say you go out in the woodshed and you got a bunch of dry oak out there that's been there for a while, and you see these little powder piles from beetles and whatnot. Somebody told me they're called dry post beetles, but I can't be sure. And I was just wondering how detrimental it is if you bring that down the basement and it sets there for a while before you use it up.
Powder post beetles.
Yeah, so a couple possibilities. Powder post beetles would be at the top of my list of suspects. Those can certainly get into oak and things like that. It turns out we actually have different species of powder post beetles, and they vary in terms of what types of wood they like, how old the wood is. Some like relatively fresh wood, some like wood that has been around for decades, like old barn beams and that sort of thing. There's also a possibility there are some other beetles that can show up in firewood and things like that. So one thing that could be helpful if you were to send in a sample to the diagnostic lab, I could certainly do some digging and help confirm what's in there. If they are indeed powder post beetles, though, there can be a bit of a concern because some of the species might go from like the oak firewood. They sometimes can get into other types of wood indoors. I occasionally see issues in like hardwood flooring, occasionally cabinets and things like that. An important factor, though, is the females of those beetles like to go to unfinished, unpainted wood to lay their eggs. They actually lay eggs under little slivers in the wood. And so if you have a hardwood floor that's sealed and it's, you know, varnished over and things like that, they don't have those egg-laying sites. So the risk would be pretty low.
Oh, there you go, Brian. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org with your insect questions. I'm Larry Mueller. Jane Rotunda, our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the world of insects today with P.J. Leash. He directs the Insect Biognostic Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us. Still some open lines at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us your insect question. Maybe you have an insect photo that you want to send in. Do that at WPR.org. Email that to us. And Kristen in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, thank you. Just a question for you and the guests, if there's any predictions on how bad the mosquitoes will be around here this summer.
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, and that's one I've been getting a lot lately simply because last year was an awful mosquito year. Very, very high mosquito pressure throughout much of the summer and then late in the season too. At this point, can't really make any really reliable predictions. And a couple reasons for that. We do have some mosquitoes that overwinter as adults, but those like to go to sheltered spots. So they may get into some natural small cave or rock outcropping. Sometimes they'll actually sneak into people's homes and hang out in like a cool corner of a basement. So you could, in theory, bump into mosquitoes on a day like today. You wouldn't see many of them, but you could potentially bump into them. When we get our bad mosquitoes, when we have a really rainy year, those are from a group we call our floodwater mosquitoes. And common species like Aedes vexans is one of our commonest. That's the inland floodwater mosquito. They lay their eggs in low-lying, flood-prone areas out in the woods. And those eggs can sit there for a year or maybe a couple of years. And so those eggs would have been out in the woods late last year or even before that, and they would have been under snow cover. So they would have been well insulated. I don't think the polar vortex would have taken those out. What I think is really going to drive mosquitoes this year is the rainfall that we get. Yeah. If it's a rainy spring, if we have a rainier like we did last year, we'll probably have lots of mosquitoes again. If it's a drier year, we probably won't have as many. So hard to predict at this point. I'm looking at the weather forecasts in the coming months.
And then for the homeowner, you know, I think you've told me in the past, change the water on your bird feeder at least once once a week, because they takes them about a week to breed, if I'm not mistaken. And small little potholes around the yard, you can help eliminate some if you get rid of those.
Yeah, it always helps to take a peek in your yard. And at first you may say, oh, I don't have any water in my yard, and you start taking a closer peek. You don't need much water. If you have a plastic cap from a bottle of drinking water, you can breed potentially a dozen or two mosquito larvae in there. So they don't need much water.
Wow.
Mosquitoes essentially need a bit of water, and then they're typically filter feeders, kind of feeding on bits of plant material in the water, so fallen leaves and things like that. So it could be even a gutter that had a little bit of damming because of leaves piled up in there.
Yeah.
That can breed them. Bird baths, kid pools, things like that, where the water sits there. So if you change that water out about once a week or so, that can be helpful to reduce some local mosquito breeding, even if you had something like a tarp that collected some water and held it for a little while. That, so you start taking a close look in your yard, and there's lots of potential mosquito breeding sources if we have a heavy rainfall year.
I had an old tire behind the garage here several years ago that had some water in it, and it was breeding mosquitoes, I am sure.
Yeah.
I got rid of the water, and it helped.
And tires are notorious. I'm glad you brought that up, Larry. I joke with folks, if you wanted to invent an item that's almost impossible to drain the water out of, it would be a tire, because you turn it this way and that, you get some out, there's still some water in there. We have some mosquito species that really prefer, as the females, adults, to go to those dark spots to lay eggs. And so if you got tire sitting around, that can cause some mosquito problems potentially.
Well, let's take another call. Steve in Antioch, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, that's a good thing, Steve. What's going with you? What do you got on your mind?
I just wanted to chime in about my own experience with bees. So this is my first winter with bees, and I'm just to your southern border here. But they survived okay, but I took some precautions, like when I set up the hive, the Waray hive, I planted a small row of Fuja occidentalis behind it to the north.
Yeah.
To block the wind, hopefully. And when I heard about the polar vortex coming, I got some cotton drop cloth, and I covered that north and the top and the sides with it. And nice thing about the Waray, they also have those little, often they have the little viewing plates on the side.
So yeah.
I keep checking on. And oh yeah, they were really active a few days ago when it was just like in the 60s in the sun for a while.
Well, good on you, Steve. It sounds like you did all the right things, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm encouraged to hear that report. I think it's great to hear. And I've heard some other folks too that they have had some success. One thing that came up in this call though is kind of that insulation factor and protection factor from the wind. If you have a hive that's in a very exposed spot and the wind is drawing heat away from it, that can make it much harder on the bees. So I know a lot of beekeepers that basically insulate their hives one way or another. Could be windbreaks, could be some wall of burlap put up around it. Sometimes folks will take that pink or blue foam board insulation and put that around the hives. I've heard of some cases where, depending on what you do, if there's not enough airflow, you can then get moisture issues, but that insulation can really help out, I think, in some cases.
Steve, thanks again. Appreciate the call. I want to give Madeline and De Pere a chance to join in. Madeline, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Last night I watched a program on the Wisconsin Channel about moose, and they sound like the situation with the moose, they might be all gone in 60 years. And they talked about these, they called it winter ticks that feed on the moose. And also they talked about some kind of worm that it sounds like it starts out in deer, but if it gets to the moose, it tunnels holes through their brain. Could you talk about that, please?
Sure.
So first, the tick. There is a tick species called the winter tick. And when I think of ticks in Wisconsin, and we're bumping into our deer ticks and wood ticks and things like that, you're really not going to bump into that winter tick unless you went looking for animals like moose, which we don't have a whole lot of in the state to begin with. But that's kind of a uncommon species we just don't see all that often, again, except on things like moose. It can cause problems for them. And those winter ticks are what we call a one-host tick, meaning that they basically stay on that one host for their life cycle. Our other ticks, like deer ticks, are three-host ticks. So they might go to a mouse or a chipmunk and then a larger animal like a deer. So they're going between different hosts. So the winter ticks can be problematic on moose. In terms of that parasite, that'd be a great question for someone like David Drake from our Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department. From what I know about it, it is a parasite that also affects deer. And if I recall, I don't think it affects deer nearly as much, but when it gets into moose, it can cause some very, very serious problems.
And that may be one reason why we don't have as many very many moose. I mean, there are other considerations, but deer and moose don't get along, partly for that reason, I know David has said in the past. So there you go. Thank you so much for that question. Let's turn to Lynn in Evansville next. Hi, Lynn.
Yes, and thank you for taking my call. I have a less problematic kind of issue, but a bug that I had seen outside took up residence in my house over the winter. It's basically flat in shape, and if you were looking from the top down, shield kind of shape, like a shield, and it has an acrid smell when you pick it up. It resides in the sunny side of my living room where I have a fireplace, but at any rate, they're few in number, and I generally kill them or remove them from the house, but they've never disappeared, so they're coming from somewhere. I'm just wondering, do you know what it is and what I should do?
Marmorated stink bugs, eh?
Yep. Larry's got it. So this one is a species of stink bug. It's actually an invasive species called the brown marmorated stink bug. And if you look at the Midwest, we've got dozens and dozens of species of stink bugs. Most of them like to stay outdoors. But this newer invasive species has been in the state almost a decade now. It likes to sneak indoors in the fall, just like box elder bugs and Asian lady beetles. And so the story with those is they were feeding on plants last summer out in your yard or nearby area. They would have snuck in probably last September, October. They might have been hiding in places like wall voids or attic crawl space. And if it's cold enough in those spaces below about 50 degrees, they're too lethargic to really move or become active. But if you get a warm winter day, they can come out of these nooks and crannies, find their way into your living room or kitchen. And it is often more on the south or western side of a home because you get that warm afternoon sun. So that's what it is, that brown marmorated stink bug. In terms of what to do about it at this point, they've already gotten in. And that's kind of where I draw the line in the sand. If you want to do something that's really going to be helpful, you got to act in late summer and in the fall to prevent them from getting into your house. So that's sealing up cracks and crevices with caulk or expanding insulation foam or better weather stripping or something like that. If we prevent them from getting in, you don't see them in your house this time of year. Once they're in, what I tend to do, and I see an occasional one around my house, I tend to grab it with paper towel and just squish it or knock them into a cup of soapy water, and you can dispose of them that way. If I were to find lots and lots of them, I would be tempted to take the hose attachment on the vacuum cleaner and suck them up. But I will say the odor, as you mentioned, it's very unpleasant and pungent.
Yes.
The first time I squished one of these, I went and washed my hands right away. That smell was still on my fingers. I probably washed my hands 2-3 times, and it was still there. So I tend to grab them with paper towel if I need to.
Or a vacuum cleaner. That works, too. I've been lucky. I have an Energy Star home. Made sure I had, you know, and it's good and tight. So I haven't had that problem in my house.
Yeah, so that brings up a good point, though. Newer construction tends to fare much better with these fall invading insects because they're sealed up more. It's often the old farmhouses and things like that where I run into the biggest issues with some of these fall invading insects.
So there you go, Lynn. The brown marmorated stink bug is yours until next, until it gets warm and you can do some sealing up outside. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Becky in Boscobel has something for us. Hi, Becky.
Hi. I just had a question regarding camel crickets. I wonder if you thought they were going to be really bad like last year, and how would it get rid of them out of your house?
Camel crickets.
Yeah, so camel crickets are a creature that I don't see that many cases of overall. They are out there. We've got a couple species around. And typically where I bump into these are damp conditions. So occasionally I see them in damp basements and things like that. Because we had a very rainy year, it makes sense that maybe there were a bit more of them in your home just because of damp conditions. So again, it may be influenced by the weather. If we've got a really rainy year for 2019, I suspect that would be good conditions for these camel crickets versus if it were a dry, droughty year, that's probably going to be harder on them. Some other things you could do if you have a lot of these in your home or basement, something like that, you could try getting the humidity down. So using like a dehumidifier might help just make the conditions more inhospitable for them. Another thing you could do, if you go to the hardware store, or most garden centers have these too, you can buy what are called glue board traps. And there's no pesticide on them. It's either a plastic tray or cardstock that just has some really sticky glue on it. And so they're inexpensive. I often recommend a shotgun approach. Put out a whole bunch of these in your basements and the tucked away corners and behind refrigerators and things like that. And you may be able to catch quite a few, and that may help to a certain extent driving down the local population.
That's assuming you don't have cats running around in your basement that might step on one. I've got two cats at home, and I wouldn't be able to use anything like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. So this glue is ridiculously sticky. So you want to put these types of traps places where cats or other pets won't go. And if you have kids in the household, put them in places and let them know to keep clear, because it's really gooey stuff, not fun to try and clean up.
Thanks, Becky, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you've got, maybe you've got a photo of an insect and want to share that or want to identify that, PJ is always great doing that. Just email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can send any question to ideas@wpr.org as well. But we'd love to have the phone calls at 1-800-642-1234. Colin and Marinette, it's your turn. Hi, Colin.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I had a question about ground bee survival tactics, if they are similar to the other bees you've discussed earlier in the show. We've got a really wet spring or a wet thaw up here in Marinette, and I'm wondering if the ground bees, where they were located in my yard, are going to be back there this coming spring, or if because of the frost and the flooding now, they are not going to make it.
Okay. And Colin, when you're talking about ground bees, you're talking about what looks like little anthills in your soil that a single bee is coming out of?
I couldn't really see any mounds. It was more of a big circular, like almost like a portal down into the ground. And they would come out, one or two at a time, and we would watch them flying in and out for hours, really.
The hole's about the size of what, a quarter?
A little bigger than that.
Half dollar, maybe? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, half dollar, sure.
Okay. Well, the reason I asked about that, when it comes to bees in the state, we've got about 400 to 500 different species. Most of those, what as an entomologist I would call ground bees, are solitary species. So those would look like an anthill in the ground that a single bee lives in. When you have a single opening with lots of bees coming in and out, or similar things coming in and out, there's really only a few possibilities. For ground nesting true bees, that would be bumblebees that would have a nest where you have lots of members living together. And most folks are going to recognize what bumblebees look like. The other common thing I see, especially in late summer, and folks call these ground bees, but they're actually ground nesting yellow jackets. And these are the ones where you go near the nest or go over it with the lawnmower and you get a bunch of stings because they're not happy about it. For those, which I suspect we might be dealing with in this case, the colony dies out in the fall. They're basically starving to death. And then when the frosts come, if there were still any stragglers, that's going to take them out. The way that they make it through the winter is there are certain females in the colony that have mated, and those will be the queens this coming year. And those queens leave the colony. They're going to go to a sheltered spot like a hollow, rotten log or some other sheltered spot like a rock pile. They're going to hunker down and overwinter there. And then once it gets warm enough, each of those females is going to try and start her own nest from scratch. And the vast majority, 90%+ of them, are going to fail. You can do a few things to try and prevent nest establishment in your yard, though. For species that like to nest in the ground, they're not great diggers. They like to go to pre-existing cavities. So we're talking about like a chipmunk or ground squirrel burrow or something like that. Sometimes a hollow cavity if there's one beneath the roots of like a tree that's sticking out of the ground a little bit. if you go and look for those types of situations in your yard and fill in those holes now, they won't have potential nesting spots. So that's one thing that you could do in your yard.
And I can tell you another thing. I was taking my trash bin back, you know, around to the side of the house and suddenly banging around back there. And suddenly I'm starting to get stung by those darn things. And I had a bag of soil that I'd used about half of, and I've closed the bag up, but apparently I didn't close it up well enough because they had made their nest inside that bag.
So another case where you had a pre-existing cavity in that bag, and yep, sure enough, they found it.
And I got half a dozen bites or stings, and it wasn't fun, for sure. Colin, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Felicia in Pewaukee. Hi, Felicia.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for the show. I've actually really learned a lot. I just had a quick question about when you go to the beach, there's the, I think they're horseflies, or but they bite you, and I don't know what's a good preventative. I've tried the electric, you know, like fly swatters, and just to kind of get to them, but they're just awful.
You mean, are these at your home or just when you go to the beach? Or
just at the beach.
Okay.
So anytime I go to the beach, like early in the morning for a walk or a run with the dog or the kids, like Milwaukee, Kenosha, even Pewaukee Beach, like any of the beaches, like they're always like there and we set up. It just makes it horrible experience sometimes to go to the beach.
Yeah.
And are the flies pretty big, Felicia, like a, you know, half an inch long or so?
About maybe like a half an inch. Some of them are like you can tell they're babies, like they're smaller than that. But yeah, some of them are about like a half an inch.
Okay. Well, the reason I ask, when I think of biting flies on beaches in the state, we do have horse flies that can be fairly common, a lot of different species out there in our area. We also have some of our deer flies that can bite humans. There's also another creature called a stable fly, which is going to look an awful lot like a house fly, but they've got biting mouth parts. And all three of those can have somewhat similar habits. The hard thing is they can be rather frustrating to deal with. If they are out in force at the beach, there's not a whole lot you can do to really make them leave the area. Repellents like DEET don't tend to work particularly well against these. A lot of these biting flies rely on strong visual cues. They're particularly evolved to respond to dark-colored moving objects.
So if you're jogging on the beach in a dark swimming suit, let's say.
Yeah, they're probably going to be more attractive. Just on a personal note, my wife and I have two black labs. If we go to a location with flies like this, they tend to go mostly for the dogs because you got these two dark moving objects running around all over the place. So
bright colored clothing may help?
Lighter color clothing may help to a certain extent. Part of it is maybe a little bit luck. I've seen cases where you go up to beach on Lake Superior and you don't have any biting flies, you're there a week later and they're out in force. For some of these flies, like stable flies, they can actually breed in agricultural areas and things like manure. And yeah, they can fly very long distances. We're talking 50 plus miles sometimes, so it's just bad luck if the wind is going in the direction of that. One thing that works well, you know, if it's not too hot, would be to have on longer layers. To have a physical barrier over your skin, maybe even putting a towel or something over your legs to help prevent bites can help as well. One other thing I've seen when the flies are really bad, like up on Lake Superior, folks will wear a mesh screen suit. Light enough, you still get airflow if it's hot, but that's, again, a physical barrier to prevent the bites. But otherwise, those flies can be pretty frustrating to deal with.
If you've got them in your backyard, I know you may have talked about this. I'm sure Phil has, about a funnel black ball kind of situation that you can set up to draw them to that area.
Yeah, so it goes back to that notion that they like dark colored moving objects, and so there are some traps out there. They use these primarily on farms, like horse farms and dairy farms and things like that. And some of them, it's basically a sphere that's black about the size of a beach ball. And it sways in the wind. The flies are attracted to that, so they come in. And then there's a tent-like trap around it. So there are some things you could do like that. I've heard of folks making their own traps using a black, dark-colored objects. And I've seen pictures of this where folks have taken like a a potted plant container and almost worn that as a hat and put Tanglefoot on it. If you know what Tanglefoot is, it's just really sticky stuff. And so the thought is they see that dark object, it's moving when you're sitting on the lawnmower, they come in, they go to that, they get stuck. And so that could be a way to work. But, it may help to a certain extent if you're on the beach, though.
Yeah,
One thing I would maybe look for, if you look at the weather report, if there's going to be a strong breeze, that may be enough to help keep them at bay. Probably need a decent breeze of 8, 10 plus miles per hour, but that could be something to watch the calendar and weather report, and that may kind of lessen their impact on a day like that.
And back to mosquitoes for a minute. Mosquitoes are notoriously poor flyers in any breeze almost. And
yes.
So good way if you want to avoid mosquitoes, a breezy day, you're going to have better luck probably.
Yes.
Yeah. There you go, Felicia. Thanks so much for calling. And let's go to Dan in Wakefield, Michigan. Hi, Dan.
Hey, gentlemen. Thanks for your show.
Sure. Appreciate it. What's on your mind?
Well, per your last caller, we have a place on Lake Superior towards Munising in the central UP. And, boy, when that wind switches to the north, it gets rid of all those sandflies. It also brings in the top surface water, which is slightly warmer, but we don't really start swimming till about August 1st.
There you go. Oh, my gosh. You had another question, though, I think, about spiders, didn't you?
Yes. We call them wolf spiders. People have called them pine spiders, wood spiders, a number of things, pine spiders. I have them out in my camp. My camp is real rustic, no electricity, no plumbing. They're good. They get after a lot of bugs. But they're mini tarantulas, and they're fast, and they're scary looking. I'm not a fan. I don't kill them. My son scoops them up in a jar, and we put them outside. But they're ferocious looking. We spray peppermint oil to try to discourage them. It seems to work. But what can you tell me about those wolf spiders?
Yeah, so two things I think of in the Northwoods. We do have lots of species of wolf spiders. There's also a close relative called fishing spiders that can be really big. We're talking like silver dollar size with the legs on them. Both of them are common in Northwoods. They're really harmless to people, beneficial predators of insects. The fishing spiders get their name. They can actually feed on small fish. What I would do or try to do in a case like this, I would look at the outside of your cabin and try and seal up as many cracks and crevices as you can to prevent them from sneaking in from the outside. These spiders generally don't do well indoors, especially during like the winter months, pretty dry and harsh on them. So they're outdoors sneaking in. If we can seal it up and prevent it from getting in, that might be the most helpful in the long run.
Good luck with that, Dan. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. PJ Leash, our guest today, he directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us your photo or question at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with PJ Leash from the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Lots of calls, and we've got some great emails, too. Maria emailed and wondered if we have Zika here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, so that's a good question and one I've gotten lots and lots of times in the last few years. And the good news for us is we really don't. We've had some cases of Zika in the state, and that's essentially folks that have maybe traveled to South America or the Caribbean or some other location where we've got Zika and the right types of mosquitoes there. And really one of the reasons we don't have Zika in our area, we don't have the right types of mosquitoes here. And there's when you think about mosquitoes, we've got over 3,000 species on the planet, about 60 in Wisconsin alone. There's a couple of really bad apples in that batch. And two I can think of associated with Zika are Aedes aegypti, the yellow fever mosquito, and Aedes albopictus, the Asian tiger mosquito. Those aren't native to our area. We've never found Aedes aegypti here out in nature. Aedes albopictus we've picked up a couple of times now in the state in the last few years. It basically gets introduced to the state in tires, which we talked about earlier. So they get shipped in. we're not seeing that they're able to survive the winter. So the winter's probably taken them out. If you look at the map of the U.S., though, both of those species can be found across much of the southern states, like southeastern states and things like that. Even though they're there, that's not the full part of the equation. You need the right mosquitoes. You need the disease to actually be present. You need enough of the mosquitoes carrying the disease. When you look at the U.S. map, there's really only two spots we've had mosquitoes transmitting Zika. That's been far southern Texas and far southern Florida, like Miami area. Yeah. So the risk for us in Wisconsin, it's basically zero at this point. Things may change, you know, decades, centuries, things like that. But for the time being, Zika really isn't much of a concern for us here.
Speaking of mosquitoes, I think Donald in Bayfield County has a question relating to mosquitoes. Let's go to Don. Donald, hi.
Good morning. Say, I'm curious, how many times can one mosquito bite a person? And also, the mosquitoes that you can hear buzzing around your ears, those are males and they don't bite, correct? Yes, no, maybe?
All right, couple of questions there.
So in terms of how often they can bite, it's really going to be influenced by the mosquito species. As I just mentioned, we've got about 60 or so different species in Wisconsin and other ones around the world. We know some mosquitoes go and they'll feed and feed and feed and really fill up their stomachs as females, get that blood for a blood meal so that they have enough nutrition to produce a batch of eggs. Some of those species might, once they've produce some eggs, might go back and feed again. We have some other species, though, that are perhaps a bit more skittish, and they will bite a little bit. And if you were, say, sleeping and you turn over, they'll very readily kind of hop off you and then maybe try biting another area. So they may bite you lots of different times trying to get a blood meal. So it really varies quite a bit on the individual mosquito species. In terms of the ones buzzing around your ear, a couple things could be going on. Sometimes you'll have females flying around that just haven't landed yet, and so you may hear those. You're right, though, about male mosquitoes. They don't bite, and they don't take blood meals. Male mosquitoes go to flowers and sip nectar. In theory, they're probably doing a little bit of pollination when they do that. Yeah. So it's only the females that are looking for a blood meal.
Thanks, Donald. Appreciate the call. Tim and Milton, your turn. Hi, Tim.
I have. It's springtime, so let's talk about Japanese beetles.
All right.
My garden, I have one set of pole beans that just got stripped to the vines last year. The rest of the garden did okay. My raspberries got hit pretty hard, too. I go out there twice a day. I knock them off. I kill them. I feed them to my chickens. Is there anything I can do?
Well, in a situation like that, maybe a floating row cover.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. So in theory, and beans are something that they really like, especially, you know, taller pole beans and things like that. If the beans have been pollinated by insects and those pods are starting to develop and pollinators don't need to get in again, you could, in theory, cover that up with a fine mesh screening, and that's going to be a physical barrier to keep the beetles from getting to the plants. So if you don't have that many beans, that might be one route that you could look at. Fairly simple to do as well, and it's non-chemical.
And cheap.
And inexpensive as well. So that's something you could very feasibly do. If you have a huge garden, you know, then it's going to be a bit more work, and you got to take the screen off to harvest the beans and things like that. But again, it's a non-chemical way. Otherwise, in terms of preventing them, Japanese beetles can be strong flyers. So sometimes folks will ask about treating their lawn where the grubs are to prevent adults, and it doesn't quite work like that. You'd really have to target a large area to be able to knock down the Japanese beetle population, I suspect. So not really any way we can really reduce those or prevent them outright other than using barriers. Sometimes we use some garden sprays in our garden. One thing I will mention, though, so 5 years ago in 2014 with that polar vortex, the following summer, Japanese beetle populations were down across the state, at least from the observations and reports I was getting. They do spend the winter as white grubs down in the soil, and typically it gets to be about October in the fall, and they move deeper in the soil, and by December they may be 8 or so inches down, and they just kind of sit there and hunker down for the winter, and they can withstand some cold. But with the polar vortex 5 years ago, it really knocked their numbers down quite a bit. I don't know if that's going to be the case in 2019, but at least at this point, I'd say that's a possibility because we did get that polar vortex again this year. It was ridiculously cold back in late January, early February. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed. There's a possibility Japanese beetles could be down this summer. We won't know for sure until July when they start coming out, though.
Let's hope so, Tim. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I'm going to take a couple of emails. Margaret emailed, we had a terrible outbreak of the rose chafer beetle on Washington Island last summer. They were heavy laden on grape vineyards, peonies, and even Shasta daisies. What are you expecting this year? Any suggestions?
Yeah, so in terms of a forecast, really hard to tell. And if you're not familiar with the rose chafer, it's basically our native version of the Japanese beetle. It's from the same family of beetles, Scarabaeidae, feeds on many of the same plants and causes almost the same type of damage. They've got a slightly different appearance. They have more of a beige coloration to the body. And in terms of timing, these rose chafers are active about a month earlier. I think of them really being active in June and early July. By the time they're wrapping up in July, Japanese beetles are just starting to take off. In terms of what you can do about them, it's a lot of the same stuff we use for Japanese beetles. We could use some of the same control sprays if need be. For certain crops, you might use the floating row covers we just talked about or mesh screening, something like that. I will mention, though, for these rose chafers, we do have some of the pheromone traps that seem to help more than they hurt with these. With Japanese beetles, we usually don't recommend those traps. They tend to just put a bullseye in your yard and draw more in from long distances. With the rose chafer traps, at least from my observations, they seem to help more than they harm the situation. They're hard to find, though, so you have to go online and order them. You could go on Google and search for rose chafer pheromone traps. I know there's a company out of Michigan called Great Lakes IPM that sells them. So if that's something you see in your area, that might be something to look into. And by the way, if you haven't bumped into rose chafers before, they're really associated with parts of state with sandy soil. And so you either have them.
There you go, Washington Island.
Yep. So you either have them in your yard or you're in a spot in the state where you never see them. It's kind of one or the other.
Margaret, thanks a lot for that call. Joe in River Falls emailed, as spring landscape cleanup nears, I will be removing lots of dead annual perennial plant debris from the garden to help any beneficial insects that may have overwintered in that material. I plan to make a pile near my compost of the dead material. How long should I leave the pile undisturbed to allow potentially overwintering insects time to emerge safely? And I would add to his email, and when would you do that? I mean, you want to wait a little while, or what would you?
Well, I mean, if it is starting to warm up, we saw daffodils starting to pop up in our yard this week.
Yeah, I've got them too.
Gardening season is nearly upon us. I would say, you know, if you want to do some gardening cleanup, you can go ahead and do that now if that's something you have free time for. It is a good suggestion, though, to take that and kind of set it aside or pile it up. Sometimes folks will take that and throw it in a heavy compost pile or, you know, do something else to it or burn it to get rid of it. But if you let it sit there, and I would try and let it sit as long as you can kind of tolerate it in your yard. There are all kinds of insects that will nest in hollow plant stems, for example. Some of our solitary wasps and solitary bees and things like that, which can both be beneficial creatures. And so give them some time. A lot of those species will emerge during the spring or summer months. So if you can let it sit there for a couple months, that would be best from the viewpoint of the insects that might be nesting in those materials.
And I don't know if you can see this on your screen, the photo, but Cameron in Madison sent us a great photo of his favorite praying mantis selfie that he took while he was in the Ukraine. And this is a giant praying mantis, but and I mean by giant, like 6 feet tall. And he's formed these sort of the same posture as the praying mantis.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sending that in, Cameron. I love that picture. Luckily, praying mantids don't get that big, maybe in science fiction movies, but definitely a cool statue and piece of artwork that you got to check out in Ukraine.
What are the first insects that will be seeing, you know, that show up in spring for us?
Yeah, so the first ones I would expect to see would be the ones that overwintered as adults in sheltered locations. I mentioned earlier in the show, you know, certain mosquitoes can actually spend the winter as adults. So you could, in theory, bump into mosquitoes even on a day like today or later this week. It gets up into the 50s or 60s. We have some butterflies that can be active at surprisingly low temperatures, like our morning cloak butterfly is one of them. They overwinter down amongst leaf litter on the ground. And so once the snow melts, poof, it's warm enough, they could become active. I've seen some of those flying around when there's still patches of snow on the ground, which surprises you to see butterflies flying like that. We also have a lot of moths that can overwinter as adults. And if you do tapping of maple trees to make syrup, you might bump into these because you have a drill hole in a tree, a little bit of sap is oozing out. Some of these moths, if it's a warm enough night, will crawl onto the tree to drink some of the sap that's coming out. So there's actually a lot of insects you could bump into here because the temperatures are up in the 50s now.
You mentioned maple syrup, and you got me thinking maple syrup now. And I imagine the tapping should be getting underway fairly soon.
I've seen some pictures of folks tapping
trees.
They're
tapping already.
I was up north in Minocqua last week, and that was popping into my head with the temperatures up there. above freezing during the day, cold at night, seemed like it would be decent conditions for it.
Yeah, perfect. Well, I tell you what, you can join in with your questions. Our guest today, P.J. Leash, who directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's been doing this for a while now. He took over from Phil Pelletieri and doing a wonderful job. If you have a question about an insect, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us your photos and questions at ideas@wpr.org. Take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back right after that. Stay with us. Having some fun today on the show, talking about insects. Larry Mueller here, my guest P.J. Leash. He manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Questions for him? Our lines are all filled right now. You could email us at ideas@wpr.org, but hang on to the 800-642-1234 number, because sooner or later there'll be an open line, and let's make it sooner. Kathy in Verona, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
I have a question about bugs.
Oh, you do?
Stink bugs.
Stink bugs.
Yeah, I wonder why so many, and we seem to be inundated with them indoors and out. Last year and this year already we're seeing them. And I wonder if they do any damage to people or animals or anything. And why are there so many?
So these are the shield that have a kind of a shield shape, the marmorated stink bugs?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so we talked about these earlier in the show, and just to quickly recap, this is a relatively new invasive species, so that would make sense why you've maybe only seen them the last couple of years, and you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, you didn't have them in their yard. So they are new, given your location in the state. I mean, here in Dane County, we're one of the worst spots in the state.
Yeah.
Dane and Rock County down towards Janesville, Beloit, I get lots of reports there. Southeastern Wisconsin, lots of reports as well. And then west side of Lake Winnebago, Oshkosh, all the way up to Green Bay and Appleton. Lots of reports there. So some spots in the state, it's been around now for 5 or more years. Those populations have really gotten to be established. So that makes sense why you're starting to see them in your home the last couple of years. In terms of why you're seeing them right now, these, again, would have snuck in the fall. From their point of view, they want to sneak in, find a sheltered spot, hunker down, and they really don't want to be active during the winter because they're just burning through their energy reserves. They're really plant feeders. So they'd want to hunker down and then leave again in the spring. And so I suspect with the temperatures this week, it's up in the 50s. We might hit 60s this weekend. Temperatures are warm enough. They're becoming active all of a sudden, coming out of their hiding spots, which could have been wall voids and attic overhangs and things like that. Some are probably making it to the outside of your house, so that's why you're seeing some there. There's also some that probably take a wrong turn and head in the wrong direction, come inside your house. So that's why you're seeing the activity at the moment.
And thanks, Kathy, for calling. Appreciate your call. Rose in Spooner, it's your turn. Hi, Rose.
Hi, thanks, Larry. PJ, I've had a problem for the last two springs, basement bathroom, around the toilet area. I have these little teeny ants, and they're coming up and bringing sand with them. Now, I can't get underneath the toilet. I don't know how to, like, keep them from doing that. They only last about 2 to 3 weeks, but I'd like to prevent it if possible. Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, so in a case like this, it'd be really helpful to collect some of those ants and send them into my lab, the Insect Diagnostic Lab here at UW-Madison. Mailing address, if you want to get some samples, I'd put them in a little container so they don't get squished. The mailing address is 1630 Linden Drive, L-I-N-D-E-N, just like a linden tree. So 1630 Linden Drive, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or if you do a Google search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, you'll find my lab website. I've got all the instructions on my website in terms of how to send a sample in. So the reason I'm asking for a sample in this case, we've got dozens of different ant species. Sometimes with ants, if we can control them with baits, it's really helpful to know the species so that we can pick the right bait that they'll go to most likely. So if you send some in, we'll figure out the species. If we can find a bait that they like, get them, the workers, to take that back to the nest and hopefully take out the colony, that might be more of a long-term solution. Otherwise, there are some ants that I see active at certain times of the year coming out in conditions like this. Citronella ant would be a common one I can think of, where they kind of run their course for a couple weeks and then they're gone. They can be a little bit frustrating in that regard. But again, if you sense them and we figure out the exact species, then I can give you some much more specific management advice.
And there you go, Rose. And they may be coming, actually coming up from the seal around the bathroom stool if it's not good and tight.
Yeah, so that could be a possibility. I do know, and given the time of the year, things are warming up a bit. There are some ants that could be underneath the foundation, and all of a sudden the heat
just move up.
Yep, just starting to move up because it's warming up, so that could be going on. But again, once we can figure out the exact ant species, then we can really kind of cue in on what we need to do next.
So there you go, Rose. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Robin in Marathon next. Hi, Robin.
I have a question on earwigs. How to, because when you plant something, it just eats the whole plant. How do you get rid of those and keep them out of your, I have pots on the deck and they get in there when it's damp.
Nasty looking things.
Yeah. So really, when we're talking about earwigs, we only have one species that we commonly see, the European earwig, not native to our area. It's been around in the state for a couple decades now. Some good news from my viewpoint at the diagnostic lab, I don't see nearly as many of these earwig cases these days compared to my predecessor, Phil, when it was a new species in the state. I know he historically got lots and lots of calls. They can cause damage to certain plants, though, especially low kind of growing plants with a dense canopy that hold a lot of moisture in, things like marigolds and hostas and things like that. The main thing I think about earwigs is they need a damp, kind of humid conditions. So if you had a hosta bed or marigolds with lots of rich mulch that's going to hold the moisture in, those are good earwig conditions. Some things you could potentially try, spreading the plants out more, get more airflow through them, keep things a little bit drier. That may help to a certain extent. We do have some insecticide sprays you can get at the hardware store, garden center, that could be used as well. Some of the broad spectrum ones will protect plant foliage from earwig damage if need be. So those are a couple things that you could try that may help out.
Thank you, Robin, for calling. Appreciate it. And Mary in Racine, we'll go to you next. Hi, Mary.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, once a year, I'm going to say maybe later in summer, we have what my husband and I call a fly hatch in the house, and we've got flies everywhere, of course, especially at the windows because they're trying to come out. We can't figure out where they come from and why this happens, and is there anything we can do?
Sure. So this would be another situation where I'd really encourage you to collect or catch some of those and send them in. And the reason I'm saying that, we've got lots of different flies that can show up indoors. Each fly is going to have essentially a different story associated with it. We've got some that if I see, you know, fruit flies, I'm looking at, you know, overripe fruit or produce or gunk in a drain or something like that. There are other flies strongly associated with clogged up drains. There are some that might indicate a dead mouse somewhere or something like that. And until we know the exact fly species, it's hard to tell exactly what the source may be. So what I would say in this case is when you see some, feel free to collect it, send some samples into the diagnostic lab. And once we figure out what the species is, then I can tell you where that particular fly is coming from.
And go ahead and do that, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. John in Port Wing emailed us and wondered why diazinon was taken off the market and is it available to certified applicators, and wondering if earwigs can prosper in northern Wisconsin.
All right, so let's take the second question first, because we did just talk about earwigs. I do get a few reports from the northern part of the state. Again, earwigs like moisture. And so if you have a yard with sandier soil, things are a little bit drier, the conditions aren't going to be as conducive for those, versus if you're in a part of the state with rich, heavier soils that hold the moisture in, you're going to have better conditions. So I've seen them in the northern part of the state. Typically, I get more cases, though, from southern Wisconsin or other parts of the state. In terms of diazinon, that is a common insecticide that was around. It was pulled off the market, about 10, 20 years ago. Technically, if you were to look in the state pesticide registry database, it is still labeled for very particular uses. They have some products that are approved for using it as ear tags for like cattle to control some pests on cattle. There are still just a couple of products out there that are available for certified and licensed applicators for like farm type situations, but it's no longer available for the general public. In terms of why it was pulled, anytime we have a pesticide, could be an insecticide, an herbicide, a fungicide, the federal government, the EPA, has to look at that product and make a judgment and weigh all the benefits and all the risks. And sometimes they just say, based on current data or newer shifts in the market and less toxic products available, they may make that decision that this product should be pulled from the market. In some cases, like with diazinon, they haven't pulled it entirely, but they have said you can only use it in these very specific situations. And in some cases, you have to be certified and licensed. So you've gone through demonstrated knowledge of handling pesticides properly, that sort of thing. So the EPA basically at some point made that call that we don't want the general public using this product anymore.
So there you go, John. Thank you so much for that email. Let's turn to Joe in Oshkosh next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I like to kayak a lot in the summer, and I've been up and down the Fox River for miles and miles, and I've never had any problem with insects. When I get out on Lake Winnebago, this happened a couple times, about 50 to 100 yards out. These little flies would come and bite my ankles, and they look exactly like a house fly, but they're about half the size. Do you have any idea what those are?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, a couple thoughts. I mean, we did talk about a fly earlier called stable flies, and those really love to go for your legs and ankles. So that would be one possibility. We do also have some other small flies like black flies that can bite. Noceums can bite. Both of those are going to be much smaller than house flies. Although when I've bumped into those, I mean, they can bite you kind of anywhere on your body, whereas those stable flies really seem to like the lower extremities, your legs, and especially around your ankles. So that would be my suspicion, is those stable flies. I've bumped into those several times up on the shores of Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. And as I said early in the program, they can be associated with agricultural areas. The larvae can breed in manure and things like that, and they can fly in from long distances, could be 20 or 50 miles down the road.
There you go, Joe. Thank you so much for calling. And Bill in Oregon will give you a chance now. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. Got a question for PJ on insect identification. We're trying to figure out, there's an insect that, it's a flying insect. It's about 1.5 to 2 centimeters across full wingspan. Assuming it's either in the fly family or moth family, but it's the distinct thing is it shows up every time it's about 40 degrees. And we'll see them during the summer, but every time it hits 40 degrees, almost any time of the year, they'll be there. And the other distinct characteristic is they gather and just go up and down, up and down, up and down in one spot, and they tend to do it either over the bird bath or over our black Coleman grill.
Okay. Bill, a question for you. Are you near any bodies of water, like a river or stream, anything like that?
Not really. Well, yes and no. I mean, there's enough. We're in a wooded area that's always damp in some senses, but there's no open water nearby, but there's things within reason, and we do have a bird bath that goes all year.
Okay. Well, the reason I asked about that, there are some of our aquatic insects that could be about that size and can have that behavior. So some of the, like mayflies, there are some stoneflies I commonly see this time of the year. With those, I would expect you'd have a body of water close by, a creek or a river or a pond or something like that. We also get some of our midges, which are a type of fly. They look kind of like a mosquito. And there's lots of different species of midges. Some can be noticeably larger than mosquitoes. And those I see very regularly orient over certain objects, a contrasting color. They kind of float up and down. Usually when they're doing that, that's actually a mating swarm. And you have males and females kind of mingling. So that could be a possibility. So I would suspect something along those lines, based on the description, the behavior. I would wonder if you're able to collect any or snap some pictures and send them to me. That may help me really narrow down what it is exactly.
Yeah. Go to the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW and you get that address to mail in. And a pill bottle works pretty good, doesn't it?
Yes. Pill bottle, small Tupperware.
Yeah.
You go to the dollar store, you can find all kinds of little containers with lid, just so they don't get squished when you send them into the diagnostic lab.
There you go, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's see, Jane emailed in and wonders, what happened to June bugs? I haven't seen what someone described as a flying date in years. What can you share about June bugs?
Yeah, so for June bugs, I actually studied June bugs or May June beetles for my graduate work. And there's lots of species in the state. We've actually got 29 different species in Wisconsin. A lot of them are going to look very similar, and you really got to get them under the microscope to tell them apart. So they're definitely out there. From my viewpoint at the diagnostic lab, last year I thought was a pretty good year for them. I had some reports, including here in Madison, the north side of the lake, of some large flights. And one situation, there was a fountain where a lot of them had ended up in there at night because the fountain was lighted. So it really depends where you are in Wisconsin. A lot of our species have three-year life cycles, or pretty much all of them do. There's one exception with the two-year life cycle. And so you could have kind of a local big explosion of June beetles in your neck of the woods, and then things could be eerily quiet for the next 2 years. So there can be this temporal variation through time. They also can be very, very localized. So sometimes you got a whole bunch of June bugs in one spot, and you go 5-10 minutes down the road, and they hardly have any. So it can be very localized geographically and temporally.
And thanks for that question, Jane. Appreciate it. Let's go back to the phones and to Suzanne in Twin Lakes. Hi, Suzanne.
Good morning, Larry. I had heard a comment on your program by another entomologist because I listen to your program daily. It's the best thing in the world. And he had mentioned that the Zika virus, West Nile, dengue, and yellow fever are moving from the southeast to the Midwest. And last summer, I was diagnosed as having a vector virus, and it was from a doctor from Fredder, and he said that their hospital had had 4 cases of West Nile virus. And I had talked to the supervisor of highway here in the village, and I asked him why they hadn't sprayed last year. You know, they used to come around with a truck. And because I live by the woods and the lake, It was like a jungle. And he said that a lot of people don't like it anymore to have that spray. And I wondered if other villages felt the same way. And he said there was some pellets that they could put in the water because I have a low spot in my garden,
yeah,
off the far end of the property. And I was wondering if having these pellets put in there when I have a heavy rain would be dangerous to the environment.
Sure. So when it comes to the mosquito pellets, what I suspect those are probably a formulation of BT, Bacillus thuringiensis. It's a bacterial-based pesticide product that is specific to essentially flies and only flies for the strain that they use. They've got different strains we can use. You can get at the garden center to control caterpillars. There's a strain for beetles. In this case, because mosquitoes are a type of true fly, they'd be using a very specific strain. It can be formulated as these little briquettes or a pellet. And in theory, you could put those in water. The way I look at mosquito control, though, is you really have to know what's going on in your area in a given year. And when it comes to something like West Nile virus, not any old mosquito can carry that disease. It's very specific ones. A year like last year, we had huge explosions of what we call our floodwater mosquitoes, and they don't really play a big role in this West Nile virus. Ironically, it's during drier years. I see more of a certain type of mosquito, like Culex pipiens, a northern house mosquito, does better under drier conditions. And one of the reasons for it is that that mosquito thrives in urban areas. And in urban areas with some of our infrastructure, we've got these rainwater runoff catch basins that hold water for long periods of time. And those mosquitoes can thrive under those conditions. If you get lots of rain, it actually flushes out those larvae and they die. So just going out there and using some of these products doesn't necessarily have much of an impact on transmission of something like West Nile. And really a big driver for that is the weather patterns influencing the type of mosquitoes that we see lots of in a given year.
So there you go, Suzanne. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. A few more emails I wanted to just check in on. Charlie emailed. He recommends duct tape for catching bugs. It works when jogging and walking and being attacked by biting flies. He said, I've learned to put a strip of duct tape, sticky side out, on the back of my hat.
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about this earlier with some of those biting flies and using a dark-colored object with Tanglefoot, which is just some really sticky stuff. And this is basically working along those same lines. We'd be using the duct tape as a sticky surface to trap them. And if you have that on, especially like a dark colored hat, undoubtedly you could catch some flies like that.
And Cecilia was wondering if it was too early for swallowtails. She was in Manitowoc yesterday and one flew about 6 inches from her windshield when she was at a stoplight.
Okay, so a couple possibilities here. One would be it might be one of our butterflies that does overwinter as adults amongst leaf litter and things like that. And so if it warmed up just enough, it's possible that you saw one of those flying. Another possibility, we do see this with some regularity. It could have been butterflies from farther to the south, and they get blown up here in wind currents. On rare occasion, I mean, we even get some species from places like Mexico that get blown all the way up here in the jet stream. So it can be influenced by some of the weather patterns. But I suspect it's got to be one of those two possibilities.
Well, PJ, it's always fun. We are out of time. I thank you so much for taking time to be with us. John in Wonder Lake emailed to say he puts a window fan outside when sitting on his deck and it keeps the mosquitoes away. I do the same thing. I do the same thing, John. Thanks for that reminder. And thank you all for listening. PJ Leash will be back May 15th, the day after my birthday. My goodness me. And he'll talk with us again about insects tomorrow. Take a look at varicose veins on the health side and spider veins as well in their treatments. And at 11:45, we'll take a look at ancestry DNA. In the meantime, hey, thanks a lot for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.